Hi, and welcome to the Conservative Roots Podcast. Today is Friday, August 27th, 2021. I'm your host, Robert. It's been almost a week since the last episode, and it's never my intention to go that long, but you probably know that this isn't my actual job, so work does get in the way. And my work was pretty badly affected by COVID, so I can't really turn down projects when I get them, but I've been trying to keep active on TikTok, at least in the meantime, and throw up some quick videos for you to react to things as they're happening, keep up with the news a little bit in between episodes. So if you're over there on TikTok, hopefully you're enjoying that as well. Now, right now, as I'm recording, I've got a little rainstorm coming in. I live in the city. I have a fire escape. So the rain is kind of bouncing off the fire escape, making a lot of noise right now. So if you hear background noise today, if you hear thunder, if you hear splashing and stuff like that, that's what's going on. I'm going to try to use some After Effects when I edit this thing, some noise reduction. Hopefully that'll mitigate it a little bit, but if it is a little bit noisy this time, I do apologize. Now, obviously, if you look around the news, the dominating subject is, of course, Afghanistan, and we'll talk about that today for a while. But what I want to devote most of the show to is still what's going on with the vaccinations, the FDA, and the passports and everything else, because as bad as Afghanistan is, and as bad as that's going to get in terms of like potential hostages, a renewed center for terrorism and all that mess that could happen. Right now, worldwide, the passports are a big path to tyranny that's not going to be easily removed if it goes through and everybody accepts it. So I want to talk about that today, too. And also, if I have time at the end, I want to put things into perspective regarding COVID and other illnesses that mankind has faced in the past, things like the Spanish flu and tuberculosis and how devastating they were compared to what we're going through right now, and how I think that they're using a lot of fear to try to get us to maybe not have a good perspective of what we're actually facing. But let's start off with some of the key points in Afghanistan. Now, I've mentioned this on a couple of TikTok videos, but if you don't follow me on there, I'm going to reiterate it right here. What's going on in Afghanistan, in my opinion, was no accident, and it's not just a sign of Joe Biden being incompetent either. I'm seeing way too many people on social media blasting Joe Biden and even my friends talking about how he's the worst president in history, even worse than Obama. How can he make all of these terrible decisions and be this stupid, etc., etc.? If you want to believe that Joe Biden is running this country and making all these presidential decisions all by himself, be my guest. I, for one, don't believe that for a second. In fact, I'll go so far as to say that I don't think Joe Biden has made a single decision on his own since he was put in office. I don't think Joe Biden can think his way out of a wet paper bag. Whatever and whoever the cabal is, the deep state, whatever you want to call him, Joe Biden and this whole administration is being handled and told what to do. And I don't think it would be any different if any of the other Democratic candidates were nominated instead of Biden. It's all the same thing. The party is compromised, not just the man. Too often we're saying, oh, Joe Biden is destroying the country. Joe Biden is incompetent. Well, yeah, no. Yes, he is. But it's the entire Democrat Party, not just Joe Biden. You don't want to let the liberals think that they just made a bad choice in the person. It's the ideology. It's the party that is corrupt. It is the party whose ideas are destructive. The corruption and the infiltration run so deep. What would it have mattered if they had fielded Buttigieg or the gun-hating ass clown from Texas, what's his name, Beto O'Rourke, right? Or even Kamala. They all would be figureheads and mouthpieces for whoever is running the show. Biden to them was the least offensive, the one they figured they had the best chance of pulling everything off with, where people wouldn't really question it too much, you know, because he used to be with Obama, he used to be part of a popular duo. So, it was Biden's turn, he doesn't really offend anybody, he's been there forever. He's not controversial, so there you go. Try to do what they did in November with Trump versus Buttigieg and everybody. Even the liberals would have cried foul. Nobody would have believed it. Look, even on Biden's first day or so in office when he started signing those executive orders, you remember that? They handed him the papers and he asked all confused, well, what am I signing here? We've seen him numerous times say things like he's going to get in trouble if he says anything or if he keeps answering questions to the press. He says something similar like that over and over and over again. I'm going to get in trouble. Get in trouble with who exactly? You're supposedly the leader of the free world, the most powerful man on earth, and you're afraid to speak? That's a little bit odd. In his disastrous speech yesterday, he said this. Ladies and gentlemen, they gave me a list here. The person I was instructed to call on was Kelly O'Donnell of NBC. Pardon? Pardon me? Instructed to call on? You were given a list? Who was giving you list of approved media to call on and instructing you on who to call on first? This is the President of the United States, supposedly. And as he's saying all this, he doesn't even sound like he's 79. He sounds like he's 109. The entire world is watching this clown, and he says things like this out loud and sounding like the weakest man that's ever held office. You think the Chinese aren't smiling ear to ear right now? You think our enemies aren't emboldened by this obvious weakness, even if he is just a figurehead? Not everybody in the world knows that he's just a figurehead. They think that he's running the show. Billions of people around the world are looking at this guy and trying to figure out what the hell is wrong with our country. He's still the visible symbol of our government, and we're projecting weakness and frailty in a world that is more dangerous than ever before. Biden isn't running anything himself. He's not making the decisions. And the fact that we can't pinpoint with any degree of absolute certainty who is running the show should scare everybody to death. I mean, we know it's the global cabal of the, you know, central bankers, the Rothschild types, influencers like Soros, etc., etc., but to not be able to know who exactly is running our country right now is just so outside of what this country stands for and what the founders envisioned for it that it's almost laughable. It's so pathetic you can only laugh or cry at this point. Now, Joe had himself a really bad press conference, as I said. He looked bad as we've ever seen him before. He looked like he barely knew where he was. He looked tired. He looked decrepit. He looked like he'd aged another 5 years since last week. And he looked frail, not just emotionally, but physically too. If you were looking for some sign of strength or a commanding presence from the leader of the free world, you were not going to find it in Joe Biden the other day. Now, the most telling part for me was when he sparred with Ducey of Fox News, when he was trying to blame Trump and Ducey reminded him that Trump was no longer president. Biden recoiled, he clutched his little folder, he put his head down almost in the fetal position and gave the world a photo op that's going to go down in history as probably the weakest an American president has ever looked, probably since our country was founded. It was the look of defeat, it was the look of exasperation, it was the look of fear. He looked like he was about to start crying, and this photo is now plastered on every single website and newspaper around the globe, representing the United States of America. Now, he also managed to say a bunch of things that were lies, too. He said that the terrorists won't win, that we will rescue all Americans, that we will get our allies out, and that our mission will go on, and that America will not be intimidated. All right, well, let's think about that. Which part of that is true? ISIS-K or whoever they're called and the Taliban have basically already won, right? They're dictating the terms of our retreat and they have seized control of the country. No one in our government except Biden is saying we're going to get all Americans out, which is going to leave them open to being used as hostages and they're going to bargain for huge sums of cash. We aren't going to get all of our allies out either. In fact, we gave the Taliban a list of Americans and our allies, gave them their names, their passport numbers, everything the Taliban needs to identify them. And what was our reasoning? So that they could find them and help escort them to the airport. They trusted the Taliban to help us rescue Americans and the Afghans that have been helping us fight the Taliban. All right, I'm going to nerd out here for a minute, but just bear with me a second. If you're a Lord of the Rings fan, why doesn't Gandalf just ride up to the Nazgul and be like, "Psst, Witch King, here's a list of a couple people we'd like you to see safely to Mordor. His name's Frodo Baggins, and we got Samwise Gamgee. Thanks, buddy, be doing us a really big favor." Does that make any sense? Do you hand the enemy a list of names of your friends? Where in the world, when in history, has that ever made sense? "Hey, Joe, where's the rebel base? We're here to help." "Oh, they're on Yavin 4. Thanks, man. Thanks for the info." You gotta be kidding me. Now, again, you think Joe Biden sat up that night in the Oval Office creating a list of names? You see what I mean? There isn't anything happening right now that wasn't supposed to happen. You think that they left $85 billion in military vehicles over there because we didn't know how to evacuate equipment? Pardon me? Really sit and think about that. Does that seem like it's even a possibility to you? Does that sound like reality? That our government and our military botched a withdrawal so badly they didn't think to take all the equipment out? Of course it doesn't make any sense. So now you have to start thinking about what are the motivations behind these, quote, mistakes that we're seeing. I touched on this on the TikTok page, but let's start with this. Biden said we've airlifted about 100,000 people, according to this article I'm looking at. And as it turns out, only about 5% were American citizens. So where are the rest going? I'll tell you where they want them to go. I'm going to take this from The Independent in the UK. U.S. Rep. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said the Biden administration needed to move as quickly as possible to raise the number of refugee visas it grants as the U.S. withdraws from Afghanistan. She called for the absolute minimum number of visas to be 200,000. I believe we need to move, and the administration needs to move as quickly as possible and as expansively as possible, ensuring that we're rising the amount of refugee visas to whatever amount is necessary, the self-described Democratic Socialist Congresswoman told The Independent. I would say the rock bottom is 200,000, but I think it should be whatever is necessary, Ms. Ocasio-Cortez said. And that needs to be expedited as soon as possible. Yes, we got that. Yes, get it done as soon as possible. Everything the Democrats do is as soon as possible. You ever notice that? That's so by the time you hear about what they're doing or you figure out their plan, the damage has already been done. And by the way, AOC didn't mention a single time rescuing Americans or making that the priority. She is laser focused on bringing in as many refugees as possible, and not only that, giving them free everything to help them rebuild their lives, as she puts it. And unfortunately, there's no shortage of governors and politicians in the United States scrambling to be the first to drop thousands of Afghan refugees into their communities. And oddly enough, the vast majority are from swing states of 2020 and Republicans who oppose Trump. You got Ducey from Arizona, Brian Kemp from Georgia, even little Ben Sasse is asking for refugees. You got Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Georgia, Florida, even South Carolina is getting into the act, right? Just strikes me as odd, especially since we are not able to vet these people. We're just loading them into a plane and bringing them over here. The Taliban themselves have already said that they're not going to let Afghans who are loyal to us get on a plane and come to America. So who is getting on a plane and coming to America? How are we to know that the right Afghans, the people that actually helped us, are the ones that are getting onto these planes and getting over here? I don't mind them coming over. I don't mind resettling Afghan people who helped us over there, helped us fight the Taliban, helped our military, and made friends with our military. I don't mind giving them a shot at the American way of life. Okay? But what I don't want is transport planes full of Taliban fighters coming over here, posing as refugees. And given the way that the Biden administration has screwed everything up so far, that seems very, very possible. And at the same time, of course, you got the fact that Biden has let in over a million illegals cross the border in less than a year. You look at what they've done over in Europe, too, over the past decade, bringing in tens of millions of illegals into Europe, mostly from Africa and the Middle East, and it's completely changed the demographics of many countries over there. It's affected the voting habits, especially in the UK and France, right? They've also watered down or forever changed or possibly even destroyed a lot of cultures of these European countries. Not right away, but the pieces are in place now to forever alter the path of European history. It is permanently changed because of Angela Merkel, the EU, and the mass migration of people into Europe for no reason. I mean, there is a reason. It doesn't make any sense. I don't understand why they would want to destroy their own culture. But that kind of thing doesn't matter to them. They want collapse. Worldwide collapse to bring in the Great Reset is what they've been planning. I'm getting a little long here with the Afghan stuff, so let's wrap this up by thinking out loud of maybe another possibility here, another motive. And you have to think dark for this one. Don't think like a rational, God-fearing human. You got to think like an evil deep state type. If you leave all that war equipment to the Taliban, is it going to sit there and not be used, or are they going to use it? How much of the country does the Taliban currently have under their control, geographically? What chance does any resistance now have to fight them? Might these weapons be used in terrorist attacks? Are we going to decide that we want that equipment back and go after it, starting yet another war, another conflict? Is all that technology going to be sold to ISIS or sold to the Chinese or the Russians? Who has ties to China? Let's really put on our tinfoil hats. I've got mine right here. It still fits. Remember all the reports about the CIA being involved with the drug trade in Afghanistan, like that's how they got money to fund their dark projects? Suppose there was a deal struck. They get their poppy fields back, don't they? I mean, who knows? I'm not saying that's a fact. I'm trying to think of any and all possibilities because we are living in a world right now where anything and everything is possible, and I don't want to be the guy that didn't see it coming. Lastly, if lots of Americans are left behind, what could they become? Hostages, bargaining chips. They could be made to say things on camera to humiliate the United States. They could be held for ransom where we're paying ungodly sums of money to them to free them one by one. It's an absolute disaster, but I don't believe everything we're seeing is just incompetence or a series of bad decisions. This happened too fast, it happened too easily, and there's too much at stake now. Something more nefarious is afoot than just poor policy and some old senile guy at the helm of our government. It's not how it works. All right, let's move on to the next topic, and that's going to be the corona and the FDA and the Pfizer vaccine. First thing, there's a lot of speculation going around regarding the Pfizer vax and if it was truly granted full approval or if it was just extended. As far as I can tell, it's a bit of both, a little bit of trickery going on. Now, I'm not an attorney. I'm not an expert on legal contracts. I can tell you what I believe the truth to be. You can certainly disagree. You can go research it for yourself. But after reading all the documents, listening to other people I trust talk about it and everything, this is what I believe to be the case. Yes, the FDA did give full approval to the Pfizer vaccine. However, they gave the approval to a new version of the vax or a new name that it's going to be marketed under. Now, I haven't been able to fully confirm, but apparently the Comirnaty, that's the new vaccine that they're going to market, is the exact same formulation as the one that they've been marketing as BioNTech. What's causing all the confusion is basically that the new vaccine was given approval for use of 16 years of age and older. In the meantime, the BioNTech, which again is supposedly the same vaccine that's available now, had its Emergency Use Act lowered to the ages of 12 and up so that it covers people 12 to 16. That's the one that was given an extension on the Emergency Use Act. When the newly released vaccine under the name Comirnaty comes out, it will only be for 16 and older, which begs the question, if it's the same formula and kids at 12 years old can get the BioNTech under the Emergency Use Act, why was the new vaccine under the name Comirnaty only approved for use of 16 and older? Also, why did a year go by of an emergency use authorization for the BioNTech with testing that was supposed to last until 2023, and now all of a sudden this vaccine, which is authorized differently for a different age group, given full approval, and we've never heard of its name before? If you look at a letter that the FDA sent, their approval letter, and if I'm able to attach it to the show notes, I will, so that you can read it for yourself. The FDA is basically telling Pfizer and whatever manufacturer in Germany that they're involved with that they must conduct different safety tests over the next couple of years. One apparently to test the safety of the vaccine in children 12 to 15 to evaluate safety and effectiveness, and another test to look for instances of pericarditis and myocarditis. These tests are not supposed to be completed and turned into the FDA as a final report until 2024 and 2025. So my question is this, the BioNTech vaccine was originally going to be finally approved in 2023. That got magically moved up. Now the vaccine gets nothing but a brand new name and a whole year is removed from the timeline. And now more tests are ordered going into 2025. So on this news, even though the Comirnaty brand name vaccine isn't available, the call for forced mandates on basically everyone alive happened minutes after this thing was given approval. The most despicable one being all the calls to have kids vaccinated against it when they've got a better chance of being struck by lightning than dying from COVID or even becoming seriously ill. Lloyd Austin, of course, the Secretary of Defense, immediately wants every single service member to get jabbed, even though it's the same old BioNTech. Which, for me, begs the technical question, can he do that when technically, even though they're supposedly the same vaccine, technically the Comirnaty brand is the one that's been authorized? And that's not available yet. In any case, this is not just an emergency use extension, and this will most certainly affect the country and the world going forward because, unfortunately, there are a lot of people out there who are waiting for this, and we're hoping to have their questions answered and their fears alleviated, but I'm not sure this FDA approval does either of these things. It certainly doesn't for me. We know what the goal is here. We've already seen it. They want the vax passports. They want society separated into the vaxxed and unvaxxed. They want you to submit to anything and everything that they say. Australia is a great example with their lockdowns and the fact that they're building quarantine camps where citizens are going to be forced into it like Jews in World War II. For what? That's the actions that they are taking to try to control our lives. But let's ask ourselves, how did this get approved so fast when they were originally saying 2023? Stephen Hahn was the commissioner of the FDA when the COVID pandemic hit, all right? He's been in office since Trump appointed him, I think it was December 19th, 2019. So he was in charge of the whole COVID vaccine development from the beginning. There's a typical schedule for testing and approval of vaccines, a full approval, and the FDA set a timeline down for testing and the approval and everything, and that stretched into 2023. He is the one that authorized the emergency use authorization for the vaccines. However, he did insist that no corners would be cut when evaluating the drugs long term. Here's a quote from Hahn. "But make no mistake, we will not cut corners on safety or effectiveness. I said this before and I'll say it again. Good science at the basis for decision making has been a hallmark of my career and is a value that I hold deeply. The American public must have confidence in the products regulated by the FDA. Speed is important, but so are safety, accuracy, and effectiveness. FDA's commitment to good science and rigorous data is unwavering, even as we look at how we can learn from this pandemic." Now enter Joe Biden. Guess when Hahn's last day as commissioner of the FDA was? January 20th, 2021, the day Biden took office. Immediately got rid of him. 2 days later, Janet Woodcock was made the acting commissioner of the FDA. Let's look into her a little bit. I think you'll see she's been a bit of a controversial figure so far. One of the big controversies with Woodcock was her handling of the opioid crisis. I'll take this from the USA Today. When the Biden administration tapped Janet Woodcock as the acting commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration, it seemed a good pick. Woodcock had spent 23 years as chief of the Center of Drug Evaluation and Research, a unit of the FDA described as its consumer watchdog in America's healthcare system. The CEDR is tasked with making certain that drugs are safe and effective, and that the health benefits outweigh known risks. The administration made it clear that Woodcock's interim role was an audition for the full-time position. Six people familiar with the deliberations told Politico that Woodcock is one of three on a short list, the others being ex-FDA Deputy Commissioner Joshua Sharfstein and current Deputy Commissioner Amy Abernathy. Woodcock's appointment, however, is a potential landmine for the new administration. The possibility she could be nominated as the permanent commissioner has sparked a firestorm among anti-opioid advocacy groups, I can never say that word, and victims of the opioid crisis. They charge that she was a central figure responsible for the FDA's failure over a quarter century to adequately control the opioid epidemic. Dr. Andrew Kolodny, a senior scientist and medical director of Brandeis Opioid Policy Research Collaborative, told me, "It's no exaggeration to say that she presided over the worst medical regulatory failure in U.S. history. I also came across evidence that the FDA was partly responsible for the epidemic. Unlike the others who were motivated by greed, the fault of the FDA was that it repeatedly failed to fulfill its role as the nation's guardian of public health. Instead, the opioid crisis is filled with instances of the FDA's timid enforcement, too easy approval of narcotic painkillers, and regulatory decisions friendly to drug manufacturers. Some of its worst lapses were with Purdue Pharma and its blockbuster narcotic painkiller, OxyContin." Janet Woodcock, often referred to as the top drug cop, had been in charge of CEDR for only a year in 1995 when the FDA considered approving OxyContin for sale to the public. Purdue managed several significant victories, despite safety studies demonstrating Oxy was safe for short-term use, mostly severe end-of-life pain. The FDA approved Oxy for a much broader treatment of chronic pain, everything from fibromyalgia to back pain. Now listen to this. "And while Purdue had not conducted any clinical trials to determine whether OxyContin was less likely to be addictive or abused than other opioid painkillers, the FDA allowed Purdue to claim on Oxy's insert that its delayed absorption was believed to reduce the abuse liability. The drug's label declared that addiction rate is rare. That freed Purdue's marketing team to push their drug as much safer than any other opioid competitor." Are you understanding this? The opioid crisis, the one that has killed so many thousands of Americans, the one where these drugs are being abused and sold on the black market, and are so addictive that they've destroyed lives and families. Remember Trump talking about them on his campaign and how we had to stop this from happening? We had to tackle the opioid crisis. Well, it was largely this woman's fault, the one who just approved the vaccine from Pfizer. Woodcock was still chief of the FDA's watchdog group in 2001 when advocates argued for changes to OxyContin label to address the rapidly increasing rates of addiction and overdose. The FDA and Woodcock rebuffed most of the proposed reforms and instead approved mostly inconsequential changes to the Oxy's label. Victims Group had asked the FDA to rescind its endorsement of dispensing Oxy for chronic pain. Instead, the revised label said OxyContin was for the management of moderate to severe pain when a continuous around-the-clock analgesic is needed for an extended period of time. Stay with me here. I know reading can be a little bit boring, but this really paints a picture of this woman. Former FDA Commissioner David Kessler contends that the label change was a blank check. The broad language resulted in billions in additional sales for Purdue. Billions in sales. Kind of like Pfizer and Moderna just reported, right? Big Pharma, what used to be the enemy of the left, where you'd see these, you know, these purple-haired activists out on the streets screaming and holding signs, down with Big Pharma. Now you have proof once again that liberals have it ass backwards. And it's Democrats in bed with Big Pharma making them vast fortunes at the expense of public health. And there's more good news. The following year, the FDA approved Endo Pharmaceuticals' Opana ER, an extended-release opioid painkiller the manufacturer also touted as tamper-resistant. When ultimately the FDA was forced to request Endo pull Opana from the market, Woodcock admitted, "We determined that the product had dangerous unintended consequences." As the Opana debacle played out for several years, Woodcock oversaw the approval of a series of controversial opioid painkillers. An FDA advisory committee had voted 11-2 against approving Zohydro, a narcotic painkiller 5-10 times more powerful than Vicodin. Woodcock and the FDA instead pushed it through. 11-2. Their own advisory committee said, no, don't approve this, and Woodcock approved it anyway. That prompted 29 state attorneys general and 40 medical and addiction experts to urge the FDA to reverse itself. Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat of Virginia, introduced a bill to compel the FDA to rescind its Zohydro approval. Instead of backing down, Woodcock and her colleagues in the FDA leadership oversaw the agency's approval in 2014 of Hisingla ER, a controversial successor to Opana. A year later, Woodcock and Sharon Hertz, the director of the FDA's Division of Anesthesia, Analgesia, and Addiction, further broaden OxyContin's indication to include children as young as 11 years old. A Presidential Commission on Combating Drug and Addiction in the Opioid Crisis concluded in 2017 that the FDA's inadequate oversight had in part caused the nation's opioid epidemic. This did not slow the FDA's narcotic painkiller pipeline. In 2018, it gave the controversial okay to Dysuvia, a pill 10 times more powerful than fentanyl. This was despite the strong objection of Dr. Rayford Brown, an anesthesiologist who chaired the Opioid Advisory Committee. Brown later told The Guardian there's a war inside the FDA between those officials who had failed to learn the lessons about the deadly epidemic and those who had. In an unusually blunt assessment, Brown said the FDA has learned nothing. The lack of insight that continues to be exhibited by the agency is in many ways a willful blindness that borders on the criminal. It doesn't even end with the opioid crisis for Woodcock. She was also involved in the controversial fast-tracking of an Alzheimer's drug. I'm going to take this from Fierce Pharma. The FDA's fallout from its controversial approval of Biogen's Alzheimer's drug, Aduhelm, is rolling on with one pivotal Democrat lawmaker calling on the administration to dethrone the agency's top decision-maker. Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia called on President Joe Biden in a letter dated Thursday to oust FDA's interim commissioner Janet Woodcock and quickly nominate an acceptable permanent chief. The moderate Democrat took aim at the FDA's decision last week to approve Biogen's Aduhelm, also known as aducanumab, for Alzheimer's patients despite intense controversy over whether the treatment actually helps with cognitive decline. Listen to this. This is unreal. To many, Aduhelm's wide-ranging FDA label came as a surprise, with some analysts calling it almost shockingly broad. The FDA didn't limit Aduhelm to the early-onset patients studied in clinical trials, but instead gave the medicine the go-ahead for all Alzheimer's patients. Now, who would do this? Who would have trials saying, this is what we studied it for, this is what we wanted to prove for, and then Janet Woodcock comes in and says, you know what, I'm going to prove it for everybody. Why the hell not, right? I'm Janet Woodcock. I approve everything. The FDA's move also went against a resounding no vote from the agency's own independent advisors last year. At the very least, the FDA should provide an explanation as to why it went against the advisory committee, which it has yet to do, Manchin argued. Did you hear that? The advisory panel for the FDA said, no, we should not be approving this drug. They unanimously voted no, and Woodcock approved it anyway. What more do you need to hear about this woman? You're probably all screaming, nothing, I'm sick of hearing you read. We get it, shut up, move on. I'm sorry if I'm reading too much, but this is important. Since the approval, three members of the agency's independent committee have resigned. One of those resignees candidly said in his resignation letter that the Aduhelm nod is probably the worst drug approval decision in recent U.S. history. The decision to approve drugs without the extra level of scrutiny about their safety and impact on public health has had lasting public health consequences, Manchin wrote, noting the same rigorous review process for COVID-19 vaccines. Now, this Alzheimer's drug that Woodcock approved, guess what the annual cost is for a person taking that drug? $56,000 a year. Are you starting to see what this is all about? Again, I apologize for doing so much reading. I know that that can get boring, but I want you to see who approved the Pfizer drug. Her history of fast approval of drugs that later turned out to be dangerous, and also this gives you an insight as to why she was made commissioner when she was. The day Biden took over, he got rid of Hahn, and 2 days later, he installed her. Now, why do you think Biden did that? We know what the vaccines are about. They were touted originally as our way back to normal, right? But almost right away, the head of the CDC comes out and says that their efficacy is waning fast, booster shots are going to be needed, and then comes out and says that the fully vaccinated can still catch COVID, they can still transmit COVID, they can still get sick from it, they can even die. Even with that knowledge coming from the CDC itself, they're still trying to force people with vaccine mandates to take a drug that never made it to the end of its 2023 trials and were approved by a woman with a profoundly controversial track record. Now, I'm not even saying don't get vaccinated. You go do whatever you want to do. What I'm saying is the argument that people who still have questions about the safety are being stupid, that's dead. The argument for vaccine passports is dead. And trying to bully people, threaten them with job loss or forcing them out of school or out of the military or anything else is devoid of any and all logic at this point. I mean, look at this right here that I found. It's from a website called The History of Vaccines, and it's by the College of Physicians of Philadelphia. Vaccine development is a long, complex process, often lasting 10 to 15 years and involving a combination of public and private involvement. Under stages of vaccine development and testing, even just the exploratory stage last year's. Listen to this. Exploratory stage. This stage involves basic laboratory research and often lasts 2 to 4 years. They go into a preclinical, an IND stage, then they start the vaccine trials that we heard about all the time on the news, right? Phase 1, phase 2, phase 3. We're all waiting on the news when they were talking about that. We all heard those three. Now with phase 3, vaccine efficacy is tested as well. And it says here, these factors might include 1, does the candidate vaccine prevent disease? No. The fully vaccinated are still becoming ill. Number 2, does it prevent infection with the pathogen? Again, no. The fully vaccinated are still able to become infected with COVID. And not only that, they're able to then pass the illness on to unvaccinated and vaccinated people. Number 3, does it lead to production of antibodies or other types of immune responses related to the pathogen? This, I guess it does. I mean, I'm assuming the answer is yes. I have heard that if you have natural immunity and you get the shot, it wipes out your natural antibodies and replaces them, but I have no idea if that's true or not. There's a lot of misinformation out there right now. Point is, 2 out of the 3 things that they look for in a vaccine aren't even present here. Yet you, if you question this and you want to make your own health decisions based on data like this, you're made fun of. You're accused of murder. People tell you that you're the reason that the virus is spreading, even though they're spreading it too. And this is the excuse they use for shutting down entire countries and building quarantine camps. Now, speaking of data, what other reasons might people have who are a little bit skeptical of the vaccine, even after full approval by Janet Fast Track Woodcock? Let's look at the VAERS part of the CDC website, which is the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, which has been around since 1990. It's there to detect possible signals of adverse reactions to vaccines, document cases, And every year, there's about 30,000 events reported to the site. And between 10 and 15% of those describe serious medical events that result in either hospitalization, disability, or death. What's interesting first off as I'm opening this here is that the average file size is 5 to 6 megabytes up until around 2018. Then it jumps to an average of about 11 megabytes. But in 2021, the file size is 107 megabytes. When you go into the website, which is the Wonder Search on the CDC website using the VAERS data, you put in your search that you want to look at adverse reactions of all vaccine types related to COVID-19, and you get over 450,000 responses. If you narrow that search and you forget about things like shoulder pain and I feel a little dizzy and all that nonsense that happens on, you know, a lot of vaccination shots, and you just put in death, life-threatening or permanent disability, the number drops to 138,692. That's people who have died, who have had life-threatening responses, or were disabled, according to the CDC website. All right, this is their data. Let's look at death only. You remove the other two categories, and we get 32,753 deaths on the CDC website from the COVID-19 vaccines. Now, that number may sound tremendous, and to me it is, but out of the 172 million fully vaccinated Americans, if that number is accurate, it's a 0.02% death rate, which kind of sounds to me like it's not that much different from COVID, is it? 32,753 people divided equally by 50 states is still 655 people. I tell you what, I'm going to have to pass. And that's just deaths. That doesn't include all the rest who have life-threatening hospitalizations or disability from it either. And again, this is right off the CDC website. This isn't conspiracy theory. It's not right-wing propaganda. Don't ban me for this, whoever's running my podcast. This is their data I'm using. So when I look at all this, I don't see people's health as the main concern. I see agenda. I see power grabs. I see governments ignoring facts, ignoring science, ignoring data, and using fear and scare tactics to get them vaccinated so that they can be given a green pass or a key to New York City or whatever they want to call their specific vaccine passport. Because only with that will you be allowed to participate in society again, unless we take a stand right now to end all of this. Any business that goes along with this should be boycotted. I put up a video on TikTok from France where a bunch of unvaccinated people are all picnicking on the streets together, sitting on the ground. It's a beautiful scene. They're outside on the street, outside of restaurants that are almost completely empty. That's a perfect example of how to peacefully protest all this. I mean, if you're a business and you impose this on your workers, I have no sympathy for what happens to you. I have no sympathy if half your customer base decides not to ever show up again. I hope you're crippled financially. This is the point in history where you have to decide if you're going to hide people up in your attic or you're going to put on the armband. Luckily, it seems like our side is growing around the world. Every single day, we see more and more people banding together. They're more concerned with their freedom than they are of a 0.02% death rate. We've been free way too long. We're not about to give this up now. Now, I was going to get into this whole other thing about their fear tactics, and what I really wanted to talk about was how past illnesses have been much more devastating. I might do a short TikTok video on that. We'll see, maybe like a little 90-second thing as like a teaser, and then talk about that maybe in the next podcast episode because it's getting kind of late. I want to get this up for the Friday night, but I'll be talking about things like, you know, the consumption, the Spanish flu, things like that. All right, so that's going to be it for today. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider hitting the subscribe button. If you know people who would like it, please let them know about it. Otherwise, how are they going to know? I'm on TikTok at Conservative Roots Podcast. I have a patriotic t-shirt shop at conservativeroots.net. And if you're able to and you feel like supporting the show financially, I have a Patreon at Conservative Roots Podcast as well. I'll probably be back here on Monday, and Monday we'll probably talk more about Afghanistan, whatever's happened over the weekend. And we'll get into these past illnesses that we face together as mankind and come through the other end. So that's it. Have a great weekend. I'll talk to you again soon. Take care.